Welcome back to Looks Like New, a radio podcast for the Media Economies Design Lab at the University of Colorado Boulder. I'm Cadalo Burrows, a research fellow at MedLab, and this is a show where we ask old questions about new technology. Today, we're joined by Dr. Nick Strenicek, a writer and political economist whose work has been central to how many of us understand the relationship between technology, capitalism, and possible futures beyond it. Dr. Strenicek is a senior lecturer in digital economy at King's College London, where his research focuses on digital platforms, automation, artificial intelligence, and the political economy of emerging technologies. He first gained wide attention through his role in shaping left accelerationist thought, most notably with the 2013 Accelerate Manifesto and the book Inventing the Future, co-written with Alex Williams. These works made a case for moving beyond resistance politics towards actively building post-capitalist futures, using automation, planning, and collective institutions to reduce work and expand human freedom. He went on to map the realities of our current system in platform capitalism, which has become a foundational techno-political text for understanding how companies like Google, Amazon, and Meta extract value through data, infrastructure, and a monopoly on power. Across this and later work, including After Work, co-authored with Helen Hester, Dr. Strenicek has consistently examined how technology reshapes labor, time, and our social lives. His latest book, Silicon Empires, The Fight for the Future of AI, turns this analysis toward artificial intelligence, offering a clear-eyed account of how AI development is being driven by massive capital investment, geopolitical competition, and corporate consolidation, while rejecting both utopian promises and apocalyptic doomerism. I am personally a huge fan of Dr. Strenicek's work. Inventing the Future in particular has been so pivotal in my own development as someone interested in and now researching technopolitics, all of which to say it is an incredible honor to be having this conversation today. And so without further ado, Nick Strenicek, thank you for joining us on Looks Like New.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm really pleased to be here.
Amazing. So a lot of the conversation that I want to have today is about your latest book, Silicon Empires. So I wanted to just start off by asking you if you could give us a little bit of a summary of what the book itself is about.
Yeah, so in a nutshell, the book is sort of an attempt to try and make sense of what's going on in the AI world. Because if you follow it with any sort of attention, every single day there's some major news story about AI. It's just a constantly changing field. There's new products being made, new models being released, new geopolitical struggles emerging, new investments across corporations. And it's just a really, you know, chaotic and complicated scenario to try and follow. So the book is my attempt to try and understand through the sort of framework of what is going on to try and be able to say, well, I understand why this investment is being made. I understand why this, you know, trade restriction is being made, to give people a lens to make sense of it all, basically.
Yeah, I definitely hear that. I think that the introduction in particular does a really great job of taking some really complicated concepts within the world of AI and presenting them in a way that is really accessible, that then ends up building into allowing you to explore some more complicated topics later on in the book. And so I was wondering if you could, in the same spirit of that introduction, kind of explain the history of AI as if I'm 5 years old. You know, I'm thinking specifically about like, what is artificial intelligence actually, right? Instead of just like a buzzword, as well as like, how does AI differ from the sort of algorithms that we were used to in the early 2010s and so on?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I mean, I wrote the book to try and be accessible to anyone. I think it's an incredibly difficult challenge to do that. So I don't think I'm completely successful, but hopefully people can, you know, come up to speed quite quickly. But what is AI today? I think it's a really good question. And particularly contrasting it, as you say, with the 2010s period. And I'll go a little bit further back, because the history of AI is sort of split between two different, fundamentally different approaches to how to build a machine that can do intelligent work. And on the one hand, you've got people who think the sort of top-down framework that you establish a set of rules, you start building up sort of conceptual relationships between representations, you build up the sort of inferential system, you build up rules of logic, and that therefore you install that into a machine and it can start to act in intelligent ways. The alternative approach has been a more bottom-up sort of thing, which is to have these large neural networks that are loosely modeled after how the brain sort of works, and to just basically feed it tons and tons of data until it starts learning on its own these patterns and connections and correlations. And basically until 2012, that second approach of deep learning, of the sort of neural network approach, that sort of approach just didn't really have much success. And then in 2012, something changed, which was one research group decided in this famous competition to use a neural network to try and win this competition to recognize images. And it ended up blowing away the competition. All the traditional approaches that had been used to, you know, to battle in this image recognition competition, they failed compared to this bottom-up approach. And so really from 2012 onwards, you've got this deep learning moment where the focus in AI goes towards massive neural networks and massive amounts of data thrown into these systems. And that's what we get throughout the 2010s. Now, in 2017, there's a particular way of doing this. So you've got these neural networks, and they can be organized in different ways. And these different ways they're organized are called architectures. And in 2017, a new architecture is released called the Transformer Architecture. And it tries to solve some issues with earlier architectures, but it doesn't really go anywhere immediately. Now, what starts happening, you know, is some people start playing around with this architecture. They start using more data on it. They start using more computing power on it. And before you know it, we have the release of ChatGPT. ChatGPT is a model which is trained using a transformer architecture, except unlike the previous attempts at it, it's using loads more computing power and loads more data to do what it ended up doing. And basically what we have today in terms of AI is a continuation of that 2012 moment. It's deep learning, but it's that 2017 architecture scaled up to 2026 levels of compute and data. So we're, you know, all the stuff that we're seeing today is really built on that backbone of the transform architecture. And that architecture is basically swept everywhere. All the sort of uses that we had for AI beforehand, most of them are now switching over to the transform architecture because it is so much more capable. And that's where we stand today, is most of what we know as AI today is this particular form of AI, particular form of machine learning in particular.
Wow, thank you for that summary. You've expressed that like the development of the transformer architecture is kind of this like watershed moment for the industry. How does the transformer architecture like function, or how is it different from what came before it?
Without getting into too much of the technical details, it allows for much more. So let me put it this way. Transformer architecture was trying to solve issues in language processing. And as you know from, you know, the autocomplete that we have on our phones, it guesses what word is going to come next. But on our phones, it guesses that word only based on what the previous word was. So it often gets it wrong simply because it doesn't understand the larger context that you might be typing on your phone or saying on your phone. Now, what the transformer architecture allowed was for a much larger context to be taken into account. And so if you talk about, for instance, a magician named Harry, it's going to know from the broader context of what it's been trained on that the very next word is likely to be Potter. It's able to do that much broader context. It's also, really importantly for the political economy of artificial intelligence, it's able to be scaled up in a way that just wasn't possible beforehand. So a lot of the key processing that was going on in previous architectures had to be done sequentially, which meant that it couldn't make use of GPUs, which are based on this parallel processing. So transformer architectures allow a lot of this stuff to be done in parallel, which allows them to scale up to a much greater scale than was ever before possible. And basically, that is at the heart of, you know, the trillions of dollars that are being spent right now. It's simply because this architecture can be scaled up in such a way that it allows for, you know, a trillion dollars of compute to become actually useful in some way.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Thank you so much for helping to demystify that. That was a question that I had from while reading the book. I think your answer, particularly around how this works in relation to what came before, like with the autocomplete on our phone, is a great transition into my next question. I think in the beginning of Silicon Empires, you have a section where you talk about how a lot of misunderstandings about AI come from just how popular ChatGPT is in terms of like really being that moment where a lot of people are starting to have access to AI. And one of the side effects of that is that a lot of our conceptions of AI are based around that sort of like linguistic approach that you just mentioned, where it is like completing a word or completing a sentence. But you make a point of making the distinction that a lot of AI models are actually built around tokens rather than simply words and sentences. So I was wondering if you could explain a little bit about how these tokens work and what the implications of a token-based AI is versus like something that is training solely on language.
Yeah, absolutely. So the idea of tokens, you know, there's, I think, a simple way to think about chatbots today and things, which is that they're a sort of next word predictor. They're a glorified, like, you know, auto predict on our phones, which is true on some level, but it is much more complicated than that. So the issue of tokens has to do with, has partly to do with training efficiency and sort of drawing out connections between words and, in fact, components of words that are frequently related together. So what happens is that in order to condense down a massive data set and make it sort of usable, is that it's simplified by finding patterns of the components of these things. So you don't take, for instance, every letter of every word in a data set. You'll find that, you know, the letters T-H-E, for instance, are very common. And so, in fact, you can take that as a token. So instead of, you know, having three separate sort of components, you've got just one component. And you can continue doing the sort of strategy of like finding patterns, reducing them down, and then turning them into tokens, which are components of words, fragments of words, and things like that. And that's sort of the technical reason why these things have emerged, this idea of tokens. And the same thing happens then when it's generating text, is that it is producing tokens, and it's producing a sequence of tokens that it understands statistically go together. The curious thing about tokens then is that they don't have to actually be language. They can be other things. They can be components of an image. They can be pixels. They can be a sequence of behaviors for a robot. They can be, you know, components of a medical image that is understanding how these things are all related together. They can be, you know, components of a DNA string. So that idea of focusing on tokens instead of language, I think, starts to broaden out, you know, what the transformer architecture can do. You can understand that it's no longer actually just a chatbot or a glorified autocomplete. It is, in fact, something which is picking up patterns across a whole string of different entities that are statistically related together.
Yeah, that does sound very powerful. It's kind of like you can put in various types of data. It doesn't have to be just text. Like you could put in medical data or sound data. And because it is this token rather than like a word, it can work in across various media types. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly.
Amazing. And so something that I was curious about while reading is what relationship you have personally, like as an individual with AI, like have you incorporated AI into your research or writing workflow? And like, if you have, how has that changed your perspective on it as you're writing this text?
Yeah. So I haven't integrated it into writing yet. I don't know if I ever will. I think, you know, I've got a quite humanist idea of scholarly research, but I do use it a fair amount. You know, I use it for personal things, but I use it for research at times as well. And one moment that sort of struck me was I asked Google's deep research to, all I wanted was to get some data on bond issuances by the big tech companies across the last 20 years. And I didn't want to go searching through all the different financial statements to grab this information. So I was like, just out of curiosity, I asked Google, can you do this for me? Can you get how many bonds per year each of the big tech companies has issued? And it came back about 40 minutes later with this effectively an academic article that said, here's the data. But not only here's the data, here's a narrative that tries to explain the data. And it broke it up into three parts of like zero interest rate policy over the 2010s, the COVID period, and then the sort of hyperscaler period post-GPT. And it was plausible. I think it didn't match up to the data, which is curious in its own way. But there was an interesting and plausible narrative that it had generated out of the data that it had found. So I was really struck by, like, you know, if an undergrad had sort of made that argument to me, I'd be like, well, it's wrong, but actually it's quite an interesting argument. So I was surprised at how capable it was. And I think there's also this moment going on right now of AI agents, and particularly through things like Claude Code. And this, I think, is really fascinating because I'm not a programmer by any means. I know the basics of Python and some other languages, and like that's it. But with this stuff, I've been able to create little mini apps that automate small components of what I do every day. And it's just been really interesting to be able to do that and to see that actually it is possible. And you know, I created a video game the other day with my 7-year-old, and we just like, I wanted to create a typing game and he wanted it to be a certain style. So we worked on it together and it worked, you know, it's functional. It does what it does. We're going to add new features to it. I think it's important if you're going to be critical of AI to be aware of what actually it is capable of doing at the moment, because it changes so rapidly. And if your only, I think, sort of intuition about AI is that you asked ChatGPT a year ago or so some question and it gave you a basic answer, I think, you know, it's changed a lot since then, and we need to, as good critics, to be aware of where it stands.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that connects really well with some of what you're advocating for in inventing the future, right? Where it's like, we now have this tool that, if we utilize it properly, has the ability to do a lot of the sort of intellectual grunt work for us, or this labor that would otherwise take a lot of time and energy, not just to do, but perhaps to learn. Like if we're trying to, you know, make a video game for the first time or something, where that would take a really long time to learn and develop those skills in order to refine them to the point that are necessary to accomplish a very specific task. If we utilize it in that way, we are able to free up hours and hours from our day to do the things that actually give us joy in the work that we're trying to do. So I really appreciate that example. I think my next question kind of ties a little bit to this, but also a bit to the transformer architecture question before, or like around the tokens. There's this essay that came out in 2024 called ChatGPT is BS, where they essentially argue that calling AI errors hallucinations anthropomorphizes the tech and shields the corporations that are developing this technology from liability. And so my understanding is that the current reward mechanisms for AI systems seem to incentivize taking risks to produce results that sound feasible, but don't necessarily have relationship to truthfulness, which is where we end up getting this sort of like sycophantic responses from a lot of these chatbots. And so I'm wondering first if that is an accurate assessment. It seems like it might not be based off of what you've just expressed around the tokens. But also, if it is an accurate assessment, do you think that this is like a technical challenge that can be overcome? Or do you think that this is a part of like what's inherent to what AI is?
I think part of it is inherent to what the transformer architecture is trying to do. And weirdly enough, and there's a few people who have now made this argument in various publications, but weirdly enough, I think one of the best ways to look at generative AI is through a Derridean lens. Like, it is a system of differences which, you know, doesn't have any sort of, it doesn't touch the real in a philosophical sense, but it produces these sort of truth effects, and there is, you know, there's space to make arguments that, you know, certain elements of it are more correct than other elements. Like, it's not just a free-for-all space. And this is all very, like, this is how Derrida saw language. It's just a free flow of signifiers interconnected that, again, produce sort of truth effects that appear to have a connection to reality. And I think that is basically what the transformer architecture is doing. That being said, given the sorts of things that we feed into it, you know, it can end up producing stuff that is strikingly like knowledgeable. This is even more so, I think, when you focus on models that are, you know, aimed at specific areas rather than trying to be the sort of generalist models, and ones that are more focused on, you know, drug discovery, for instance, and things like that, that are trained on a very particular set of data to produce very particular things and under very strict constraints. It becomes harder and harder to say that there is no relationship to truth or reality there. And then the final thing I would say is that there's also been, over 2025, a lot of the improvements in the AI models have come from reinforcement learning. So basically what you do with these models is you train them on the internet, you train them on these massive data sets, and then you have this sort of generalist model. And over the course of 2025, what they've done is they've taken those pre-trained models and they've done reinforcement learning on them, which is to say, you get them to do something and then you reward them, or you sort of effectively punish them. You say, this was the right way to do it, this was the wrong way to do it. And through that, these models have been able to learn sort of new behaviors. Now, the two key areas where this has been possible is in mathematics. So there's models which are now, you know, performing mathematics at the highest levels of what humans can do. And it's also been performing really well in coding. And what's common to mathematics and to coding is that there is a sort of verifiable output that you can say, this was the right way to do it, or this was the wrong way to do it. You know, there's sort of a clear, correct answer, which for reinforcement learning is absolutely essential. If you have an output which is much fuzzier in terms of whether it's right or wrong, reinforcement learning at the moment just doesn't really work well with that. So that's where we've seen the improvements. And I think you can make an argument that the models that we have today are increasingly good at mathematics and increasingly good at coding. And they do have a sort of relationship there, again, to some sort of truth, knowledge, or reality, or whatever we want to call it.
Yeah, it's the way that the technology works well for questions or problems that have an objective answer. But when it comes into disciplines like within the humanities, or if we're asking ethical questions, like, those are things that we ourselves as humans do not necessarily have an agreed upon truth for, right? Like, if I ask you, what's the best movie that came out this year, I'm going to get as many answers as there are movies that came out, right? You also mentioned something there that really piqued my interest around how, when we are trying to create AI systems that are more general, right? Like, if we're working towards, for example, AGI, right? versus when we are building systems that are specific to a particular industry or a particular discipline, the results are going to vary widely, right? So I wanted to kind of tease this thread out for a little bit. So how do you personally define AGI, and why do you think the industry's definition of it is so slippery?
Yeah, so I'll begin with the sort of the industry's definition, which in so many cases is more a matter of hype and stirring up a narrative for investment than anything else. I think if you look at the actual sort of official definitions from OpenAI and DeepMind and others, they tend to center on AGI as an artificial intelligence that can do any sort of economically meaningful work that a human can do. And increasingly, with the extra qualification that it's any sort of economically valuable work that a human could do on a computer. So it excludes, you know, the sort of the physical tasks that might require a robot. It excludes things that might not be considered economically valuable. There's a range of things that just aren't counted in these sorts of definitions, which I think is fine. I mean, at least it's a more or less clear definition rather than just the sort of pointing to a future utopia saying that's AGI and we're aiming for it. My own definition, part of it has to do with conceiving of AI as a general purpose technology, just one of the basic premises of my book, Silicon Empires. And if you take it as a general purpose technology, there's a distinction between the general technology and the specific applications made of it. And what we find today is that these general models, they do require a lot of work to be useful in specific applications. So you need to modify the interface. You need to change the data that is trained on. You need to change how things are computed in order to meet regulations. You need to think about how these things are actually being fitted into workflows and things like that. So basically, there's loads of work that needs to be done to turn that general model into a specific application, which is basically the hurdle of adoption that we see, you know, everywhere at the moment. Now, my definition of AGI then sort of falls out from that, which is to say that insofar as the hurdles of a specific application disappear, we are reaching towards AGI. So this would be like an AI model, which didn't have to be specifically trained on a particular data set, that it would have the capacity to move into a new field and understand new things. That, for instance, it could generate on the fly the interfaces that are necessary within different application areas, and that it wouldn't just be the sort of text box chatbot that we have today. So all of this is, you know, I think that's sort of what artificial general intelligence is that when we don't have to actually adapt the model anymore to these specific applications, it's just there and ready for us to use.
I thank you. I really find that answer particularly helpful. I think that my first exposure to the idea of AGI was more from the critical standpoint. And I think that a lot of the critiques that people have of AGI is more about the ethics of it and the like philosophical implications of it rather than necessarily from a technical standpoint. And so I really appreciate you kind of grounding it in what would this look like in a lived reality rather than necessarily in our ethical understanding of this technology. And so that kind of brings me to...
I'll make one quick point as well, because I think a lot of times the definition of AGI often smuggles in particular philosophical ideas about self-awareness, about agency, about drive for persistence. And this is where you start to get these sort of existential risks things emerging, because, you know, there's attributes of personhood that end up being applied to AGI. And I think it's worth separating these characteristics out, that you can have AGI without, you know, a will to persistence, without a drive for power, without a sort of fully autonomous agency. So yeah, I think it's worth separating all that out.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, that prompts a really good question of, well, let me give some background and then I'll ask my specific question. There was a really bombshell essay called The Terrestrial Bundle by Timnit Gebru and Emil P. Torres that argues that AGI as like a goal is rooted in a kind of eugenicist ideology by way of the philosophical leanings of many of the founders and funders that are actively pursuing its development. And so you just said that you think it's worth it to kind of separate out the ways in which the people who are pursuing this technology have imbued it with a particular ethic or idea. And I'm wondering how possible that is, right? If we have this industry that requires such an immense amount of money and technological computing power and, you know, to a certain extent, the formation of particular regulatory environments that make it possible for these technologies to be developed, is it possible to create AGI without it being inherently imbued with the ethics of these massive corporations and their god kings that have put in these particular ideas into the development itself?
So I think it's 100% theoretically possible. The sort of more pressing issue is whether it's practically possible. And I think this is where it's really, I mean, this is one of the reasons why I wrote the book, is to really push for a broader sense of values and collective input into what these models are, you know, the sort of values that they hold, because they do hold values. Grok is very clearly different from ChatGPT. And, you know, Chinese models have different values embedded in them. And there's all sorts of different sovereign AI efforts trying to build models that have, you know, reflect different cultural values. So they clearly do embody some values. And I think Grok is the most explicit, you know, expression of this, because, you know, there was that one point that if you ask Grok about who Elon Musk is, and it would just go on these extremely massive exaggerations about, you know, I don't know, his sexual prowess and things like that. Right. Just absolutely ridiculous claims. And you can see that this is the expression of one man and a bunch of sycophants around him, basically. But yeah, so I think this is a really big political question. And part of it then becomes a matter of how do we ensure that that there is sort of a true democracy in these AIs, because the companies will talk about democracy in AI, but what they mean is that everybody has access to their model that they're paying for. But actually what real democratization of AI would mean is that there is a collective say about the sorts of values embodied within these things. And I think there's been some really interesting work from a collective intelligence project on precisely this sort of issue, thinking about, you know, what would the, you know, in the same way that we have sort of institutions for democracy, there's different institutions that need to be built up in order to establish these sorts of values put into these models. And it only becomes more important as these models become more capable. So, yeah, I think it's theoretically possible, but it is a political goal rather than something which can just be done now.
Totally, totally. I'm interested in the potential for local models to help realize that goal, right? Like right now we're starting to recognize how dangerous like the centralization of AI in terms of like the resources and the funding, the implications of that in a broader sphere. And so I'm wondering, could like more adoption of people running these models locally have that sort of democratizing effect? I know that in the book you make this distinction to say that like there's a stack here, right? Like you have the training that happens, and that's where a lot of the like environmental costs are born. But when it comes to the implementation of it and like maybe someone's day-to-day, how do local models play into that conversation?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it might be one of the things I change in the book if I had the chance. The book was written, finished in April of last year, 2025, and obviously lots changes in the AI world. Most of the book, I'm quite pleased. I would leave it as is, but there's a few things I would change, and one of them has to do with sort of my stance on local models. I think I've become much more receptive to local models as an option lately. Partly this has to do with the shift towards agents. And agents are, so the simple way for anybody who doesn't know, basically what we've mostly had is chatbots where you ask a question and it returns you an answer. With an agent, basically what you're doing is you're setting it a task. That agent is then going and performing a series of actions in order to achieve that task and then eventually coming back to you with the final product. What's been curious, though, is that even the very best agents are now relying upon what are called sub-agents and multi-agent systems, where what they'll do is they'll effectively, the large model will spawn off a bunch of different smaller models to go and do very particular tasks. And it ends up being a sort of team of agents which are performing like a coding task, for instance. You might have, for instance, an agent which is writing the plan for the program, for the, what the coding is going to do. You might have an agent which then writes the code. You might have an agent which then checks the code. You might have an agent which then sort of tries to red team the code and hack into it. And then you might have an agent which, you know, sort of adds in descriptions of what was done so that, you know, people can read it and understand it. But for all of that, it's relying on much smaller agents, which could be run locally. You know, you still need a fairly powerful computer to do it, but they could be done locally. And the viability of that sort of local first approach, I think, is actually becoming much more significant just over the past 2-3 months, really, in a way that wasn't always obvious beforehand. You know, to use a local model beforehand was to make a clear step down in terms of what was capable and what was possible. But that's not so much the case as anymore. The other thing I would say is I think there's a really big political challenge here. And Seth Laser has been really good on this. And I take a lot of this from him. There's a division between platform-centric agents and more personal localized agents. And what the companies want is agents which are run through platforms like ChatGPT, like Claude, like Gemini. And they then collect all of our personal data. Mm-hmm. And those agents become incredibly useful for us. We're seeing signs of that already. Like the value of personal data to these things is immense. The alternative is that we keep our personal data for ourselves. We store it on our local computers, and it's interoperable with all of these different platforms, but we can then move it very easily, and we're no longer tied down into one particular service the way we are so much with social media. So yeah. There's a real, I think, important step to take by governments and by people building this stuff is that to build interoperability of agents in from the very beginning, rather than getting what we did with social media, which was massive platforms centralizing all this information, and then us saying, oh, that's a problem, we should fix it. Let's prevent it from the beginning. And I think that's a really important thing that needs to be done right now.
Yeah, I think one could even imagine some sort of data commons that allows for people to like give consent for their data to exist in these larger banks that people can then use to train new models on, but then you could also meaningfully withdraw your consent. I mean, are you aware of any sort of protocols or actions that people are taking to make this a reality?
There's one whose name I can't remember offhand, unfortunately. I think it's called like human to agent protocol or something like that. And it's about precisely this portability of personal data. And if you play around with agents at the moment and you see sort of what people are doing with it online, you get a really clear sense of exactly how valuable that stuff is. Like the better an agent knows what you do on the computer, the more valuable it is by a long shot. If that, you know, if that data just gets captured by one company, you're stuck with them in a way that you aren't even stuck with social media. Like it is much more difficult to move once that data has been captured. Hopefully people are working on this, but yeah, it's a big issue.
Yeah. And I mean, I think this opens up another question around this conversation of like profitability within the AI space. I think like if we think in terms of cash flow and market returns in like the capitalist marketplace that we currently exist in, you talk about in the book how like so many of these systems still have not been able to turn a profit. But if we think of data as a form of inherently valuable outside of the ways that it intersects with the capitalist market, it seems like we're in this situation where we're kind of measuring the power and value of these AI systems through a metric that is outdated, right? Like it would be kind of like measuring a capitalist's wealth only by how much land they own rather than the ways in which they control the means of production. And so I'm wondering if it's possible for us to evaluate the health of the AI industry looking past these traditional financial balance sheets and like think about data as a resource that's valuable in its own right.
Yeah, I think it is important. And I think, too much critical focus on, is this an AI bubble? What's going to happen when it pops? I think that's valuable, but the bigger point I think is that even if and when this AI bubble pops and bursts and there's the wreckage from it, AI as it exists is going to continue on, and as a critic of capitalism, I'm interested in these major transformations of capitalism and not necessarily the lives and deaths of particular companies within it, only insofar as they sort of represent particular, trajectories of transformation. And I think that the problem with the AI bubble focus is that you do end up just looking at, like, is Oracle going to survive? Is OpenAI going to survive? And, like, it's an interesting question, but there's I think, bigger issues as well that get neglected by that sort of perspective. So data is I think crucially important, but it's increasingly such highly specific data that is important, like your personal data and how it differs from everybody else, or the personal data of these employees in a particular law firm, for instance, or a particular pharmaceutical company. It ends up becoming, so highly specific that on one level, it ends up being hard to value because it is like, it's almost a singularity rather than something that is like a commodity in any sense. But there is clearly strategic value to be had from accessing and controlling particular bodies of data.
Right. It's like a part of the challenge is the fact that data in its raw form is not all that valuable to me as an individual, right? Like if I text you to say that I'm going to be late for something, that information is valuable to you in that moment until I arrive. Whereas the company that is sitting between me and you is able to get like an outsourced amount of value from that information, because then they can sell my data to a watch manufacturer or an advertiser that will then give them some sort of return outside of the value that that data represents as an abstraction of information, right? It sounds like a part of what you're saying is you're less interested in, is this specific company going to survive? Like, is this specific company going to overtake another company? And more this question of like, is capitalism going to survive, or is it going to transform into something new? There's a text called Capital is Dead, Is This Something Worse by Mackenzie Work that makes the argument that we're actually in the process of evolving out of capitalism and into a new economic system that is centered around data as a new form of capital as a currency, as a raw resource. And, you know, after reading Silicon Empires, I think you could also make the argument that data, as it interacts with AI systems, has the power to challenge labor, like as a economic force, right? And so I'm wondering how your conception of platform capitalism differs from Work's concept of vectorialism. And if you think that we are now, particularly given the rise of AI, exiting from capitalism into a new system, even if it's not Work's conception of vectorialism.
Yeah, so I really like Work's work. And, you know, there's Yanis Varoufakis's techno-feudalism book that is openly inspired by Work's book as well. And yeah, there's a series of, I think, more or less influenced by Work's people who have taken up this techno-feudalist idea. And I fundamentally disagree with the core premise, but I think I have a lot of sympathy for all these positions because I think they point to the right symptoms that are important to interrogate, but then they just sort of diagnose those symptoms in a different way from me, in a way that I think is not correct. And so symptoms are things like the rise of intangibles, the rise of data, particularly the rise of rent over profit, is an increasingly important element of contemporary capitalism. But for me, all of these things are components of a broader capitalist system. And rent has a long history of operating within capitalism in sort of capitalist forms. Like rent is not opposed to capitalism. It's a component of it. You know, it's part of the ways in which if you're, you know, orthodox Marxism, it's like total surplus value produced is then carved up between all of these different companies. And a part of it goes to the rentiers, it goes to the financial people, it goes to governments, it goes to all these, you know, organizations which are not deemed productive of surplus value, but they extract a rent. And so rent is not, again, it's not opposed to capitalism. So for me, the issue then becomes about sort of within a capitalist system that's still oriented towards the accumulation of capital and the pursuit of, you know, profit and surplus value through more or less competitive means, to try and sort of look at what's happening today in that framework. And I think, you know, platform capitalism, the basic premise of that book is to say, well, these platforms are, you know, as was sort of common at the time, they're often taken as cultural phenomenon, or they were taken in sort of, you know, other sort of perspectives. And I tried in that book just to say, well, let's take them as economic actors and see where this gets us. And then particularly, let's take them as capitalist actors and see where this gets us. So a similar sort of thing goes with Silicon Empires, that I think these firms are capitalist firms pursuing profit and at a systemic level, the accumulation of capital. And from that premise, where does that sort of get us in terms of what they're doing, their behaviors, the tensions between these different groups? And then also, which wasn't in platform capitalism at all, but the ways in which all of this intermingles with contemporary geopolitics, and the ways in which the state is now a much more involved actor than it was under that sort of peak Obama neoliberal period. Yeah, so for me, I don't take up that techno-feudalist perspective or the capitalist denser perspective, but I think that they point to so many correct things despite that.
When I look at your work, or at least the text that I've read, I feel like each of these books has a different relationship to like optimism and pessimism. So when reading Inventing the Future, it feels quite utopian, and not necessarily in the way that it doesn't paint a positive portrait of what we're experiencing today, but it does make an explicit call to action to build a better world in a way that, you know, ultimately makes the assertion that it is possible to exist in a better world. And then platform capitalism is a bit more grim in that it is so focused on our current techno-political reality. And it's been quite a while since I read it, but from what I remember, it doesn't necessarily like outline a way out in the same way that Inventing the Future does. And then now with Silicon Empires, you like very explicitly reject both this industry hype that we see from the technologists who are producing this technology, and also the doomerism that we see from like more political conversations around artificial intelligence. So I'm wondering like how your own personal theory of change has evolved over the course of the last few years, and how much those ideas from Inventing the Future still animate the work that you're doing.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think for me personally, those ideas are still at the heart of what I'm trying to do. Inventing the Future, so wrote it, you know, then I went to write my next book, and it wasn't platform capitalism to begin with at all. Instead, it was going to be a sort of intellectual history of repurposing technologies, looking at sort of, you know, early Marxist and Soviet debates about technology and sort of the 70s moment with various socially useful technologies and some other approaches. And as I was writing it, it felt utopian in a bad way, because it was talking about all of this technology and repurposing as though there was no impediments to it today. And so I remember, I still have these notes somewhere. I've got like 10,000, 20,000 notes for this book that was never written. And then I wrote Platform Capitalism as a sort of analysis of like, here are the hurdles to getting a better world out of the technology that we have. And Silicon Empires is very much the same thing. It's an updating in many ways of platform capitalism for the contemporary period, because the focus is not on, you know, social media platforms. It's not even on gig labor platforms. It's on these massive infrastructures, these, you know, huge rollouts of compute and energy and everything. And it's a different logic than the platforms, but it's still an analysis of like, here are the major hurdles to using this technology in better ways. Like, this technology I do think is useful in many, many ways, and to use it in these beneficial ways, not just on an individual level but on a social and a collective level, I think really requires squaring up to the forces that are preventing us from doing that sort of thing. So that's what the book is all about, is both the capitalist forces and the geopolitical forces that are driving the development of AI technology in particular directions against the collective interests.
Yeah, thank you for such a great articulation of that journey. And I would love to check out those notes sometime, or, you know, here's to hoping that maybe one day that book still does come out. We're getting up to the end of time here, and so I just wanted to ask you one last question, and kind of like tying back to that question of theory of change, you know, so as you're seeing these massive changes and this evolution of something new beyond just the platform capitalism that we experienced before to these now like huge infrastructures of centralized resources and compute power, et cetera, where do we go from here? Like, what advice would you give to people who want to do something about this and like maintain a level of agency as this new challenge presents itself?
Yeah, it's a difficult question. It's one I've been trying to grapple with for a while. And I don't think there's one answer, and I don't think there's any easy answers. I think, there is a much greater awareness today of the impacts of data centers on local communities. And I'm not totally against building data centers in various areas, but I think every effort has to be made to ensure that there aren't harmful impacts on local communities. So whether it be, you know, companies subsidizing electricity bills, or ensuring that, you know, the water supply is not tainted or anything, or that like is taking up too much water. And then also the tax issue around data centers is really big, because there's oftentimes so much competition by local areas to say, oh, you know, we've got $1 billion investment from this multinational corporation. Look how well we're doing. But in fact, in order to do that, they're often competing against each other, these local communities, and they offer tax subsidies as a sort of perk to attract these companies. But tax revenues are actually one of the only clear benefits that a data center can bring, because they don't bring employment. You know, there's very few people that are employed by these things, but they can bring in tax revenues. So I think local communities, you know, if they're going to collectively accept a data center being built in a local area, it has to, you know, take into account all of these different local concerns. So I'm encouraged by the level of protest, because I think the sort of deals that local communities will get are much, much better than even a year ago what they would have gotten. And then I think there's the sort of technical level, which is, you know, building up these protocols, building up this interoperability, building up, you know, the infrastructure, the scaffolding, the harnessing that's required for these models, building all of that in a way which makes them so that they're not reliant upon OpenAI or Anthropic or Google or any other major company, but instead they allow for a truly open sort of system to emerge. That I think is really important to be doing. And then I would say, and this isn't at a local level by any means, but I think if, you know, for governments thinking basically, we don't want to be dependent on the US tech stack, and we don't want to be dependent on the Chinese tech stack, what is the alternative? And I think the answer that so many of them have taken, and it's the wrong answer, is to chase after what America is doing and trying to build these massive models and spending exorbitant amounts of money to do so. And that's just it's a fool's errand. It's a huge waste of money. You know, instead, the better option is to focus on, well, how can these tools actually be used? How can they benefit us? And then what are the, you know, the compute needs for that? So I'll give a very brief example, which is, if you want to train an AI model, at the moment, it has to be done in a centralized way, which is why you're developing bigger and bigger data centers requiring more and more energy. Now, that's to train the model, but to run the model, you don't need a big data center. And in fact, it can be problematic because the big data centers are often somewhat remote areas. Instead, you want smaller data centers in near populated areas. So if a government is saying we want to follow America and build massive data centers, that's the wrong way. You know, they should be thinking about inference and running the models rather than training these models. There's things like that that governments need to take into account when they're thinking about, well, how do we avoid dependency on the American tech stack or the Chinese tech stack?
Right. Thank you. I really love those answers, particularly what you're saying in your second response around developing these protocols and these technologies that allow us to take back some of this agency. I'm a big proponent of like decentralization, especially on like a technological level. So it's interesting to hear you kind of talk a little bit about decentralization, both there as well as in your latter answer around the approach that governments themselves should take too. Yeah, thank you just so much for participating in this conversation today. It was a real honor to talk with you, and I look forward to speaking again in the future.
Thank you very much.
You have been listening to Looks Like New on KGNU's It's the Economy. Looks Like New is a show that asks all the questions about new technology, coming to you from the Media Economies Design Lab at the University of Colorado Boulder, and is produced by Alexander Lipka. You can find us on the fourth Thursday of every month on air or online at lookslikenew.net or wherever you get your podcasts. We hope you'll join us next month. Thank you for listening.